Hello and welcome to The Wire, your independent national coverage of the current affairs right across Australia on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Amina Shakir coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. And today on the show...
That racism makes people sick, but it also means that people who are sick are not getting better when they go for health services, or they're getting worse.
A new report shows racism in the healthcare system is causing early deaths.
The Australian Red Cross, and with Red Cross, I am the emergency services volunteer. This means that I help people prepare, cope with, and recover from emergencies.
We speak to the winner of the Outstanding Contributor at the Multicultural Queensland Awards last week. And later today...
It points precisely to the fact why our Privacy Act is not fit for purpose, and it needs to be replaced with something that is compatible with today's technology-driven environment.
Experts questioning the government's plan to ban social media for under 16-year-olds. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. A new report from the Australian Human Rights Commission has found that racism in Australia's healthcare system is causing serious harm, including chronic illnesses and premature death. The report is calling racism a public health emergency and is urging immediate action. I spoke to Race Discrimination Commissioner Giridharan Sivaraman about the need for action. You've described racism in the healthcare system as a wake-up call. What do you mean by that?
I don't think that racism in the health system has been taken seriously, and that's pretty bad when you consider that racism makes people sick, but it also means that people who are sick are not getting better when they go for health services, or they're getting worse. So we're talking about a problem that kills people. And I think it's sometimes seen as somehow separate from the health system, but it's actually part of it. It's imbued in it.
You just said kills people. How is racism in the healthcare system actually leading to people getting sicker or dying earlier?
Well, I'll just give you one example out of many. There are diseases which have been eradicated in the rest of the population that are still killing Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today. And that happened as a result of racism that's baked into our health system. It's because of a lack of cultural safety, a lack of understanding, a lack of belief in First Peoples, a lack of community-led solutions. Those are all symptoms of racism, and they're leading to the most disastrous of outcomes.
What specific changes do you want to see immediately implemented in hospitals and clinics to address this, I guess, systematic racism?
We've provided solutions in the National Anti-Racism Framework. That's the thing. The solutions are there, ready to go. We've got solutions related to health, which include mandatory cultural safety training and anti-racism training within the health sector, funding and supporting community-led solutions. All of those are in the National Anti-Racism Framework recommendations. But to date, all levels of government simply haven't responded to the National Anti-Racism Framework. We've had no commitment to implementing its recommendations.
And why do you think that's the case?
I'm not sure. I haven't been given information that would explain why. Perhaps they think it's too hard or too big, but I would say that if you don't implement the recommendations when it comes to health, you'll have disastrous outcomes, increased health costs, and people dying. So it's a no-brainer. Implementing the solutions will clearly make people's lives better. You've just got to start somewhere.
The report also highlights the widespread, I guess, mistrust of the healthcare system among First Nations and culturally diverse communities. How can the trust kind of be rebuilt?
It starts with building cultural safety. The reason people don't trust health systems is because they don't feel culturally safe when they go to get medical help. So if you can't expect people to completely modify or change or assimilate just so they can access health system. As a health service, you need to change so that you are actually adequately addressing the needs of the people you're wanting to help. And that starts with mandatory cultural safety training and principles, as well as anti-racism training, so that the health service providers, who I'm sure want to do better, can do better.
How will the Commission ensure that the recommendations in this report lead to a lasting change?
That's always a challenge, because all we can do really is advocate for the recommendations to be taken up. And certainly I'll be writing to the Health Minister and others asking for support of the recommendations. I think that we need support from community and others who should also be advocating for the solutions to be adopted by government. It's only if we together call for these answers that systems will change.
That was Race Discrimination Commissioner Giridharan Sivaraman speaking to The Wire. Ben Mayo came to Australia 2 years ago and saw the support needs for Australians with a multi-ethnic background. Working at the Ethnic Communities Council of Queensland, he also now volunteers at the Red Cross and has translated information in Kiswahili during Cyclone Alfred. He won the astounding contribution by a new Queenslander at the Multicultural Queensland Awards last week. The Wire's Tony Pankalush spoke with Ben Mayo about his volunteer work.
Apart from working with ECCQ, I also volunteer with the Australian Red Cross. And with Red Cross, I am the emergency services volunteer. This means that I help people prepare, cope with, and recover from emergencies. The reason one was floods in far north. I went to Townsville and Ingham, and there's a little village called Forest Beach, and that's where I was to support communities who were affected by floods. So my role was to help people with filling forms. There was a recovery center who are coming for information, wanting to know how they can get help. And so one of the people that was there was me. I was welcoming them to the center and also offering psychological first aid. And apart from that, I also train Queensland children to prepare for disasters. There's a project at Red Cross, it's called the Pillowcase Project. And so it's just preparing children how to prepare for disasters, and it builds their resilience.
From my understanding, you also help young people and parents reconnect in the communities. Could you talk a little bit about this?
Yes, I work with community groups, and there's one that I help connect parents, as in building that relationship between parents and young people. You know, when people come to Queensland or Australia in different ways, there are some who come as refugees and others asylum seekers. And so there is a change of culture and water view and trauma that people go through in their refugee journey. It's not easy. So that affects their relationship between parents and young ones. So when they come here, first of all, the language is different. You'll find there are people who can speak more than three languages. And so English is like fourth language. So when parents want to fill, for example, forms here and there, they rely on their children because they easily cope up very fast. And now there is a shift of power in the household. And so that affects the relationship. So mine is to work with them, organize events and activities, be it soccer, be it coming together, organizing events like food, going to the park and just chat, because there is that intergenerational gap. The way parents want their children behave or to dress is different, because the young people that I've worked with, they tell me, for example, my parents want me to dress like 1950s or 60s, but no, it's different. There is this dual culture. Like when I'm at home, my parents want me to behave in a certain way or to walk in a certain way, speak in a certain way. But when I'm outside, the society or the general public, they see me differently. They want me to behave differently. So they don't know what thing to take. It's kind of challenging to them. And so mine is just to organize these events and bring them together. Then we have organized career talks, because they have said that, yes, Australia, there are many opportunities here, but they don't know how to access them. So mine is to organize and link them to services. There are some who are requesting for mental health services. and mine is to refer them to mental health service providers. And one of the things that I do is I do warm referrals, not just giving them numbers. Oh, this is Lifeline number. Just call them. Oh, this is... But I take them, I introduce them, make sure they feel comfortable and introduce them. So once they get comfortable, then they can proceed. And also reminding them that there is help. If you also want to utilize the translation services, they're available and it is your right to use such services.
I understand you've got so much accomplishments under your belt, like whether it be in the Red Cross, ECCQ, in what you're doing with here in Logan to help the young people. What do you consider to be your most proudest accomplishment?
Wow, a difficult one. There are many areas that I'm proud of, but allow me to speak to one. I coordinate English language classes in Logan. Now, you'll find that it's a mix of both men and women. So they are coming and they want to learn English as a fourth or fifth language, because you'll find in that particular class, they speak their local language. So let's say Kinyarwanda or Kirundi. And then apart from that, they speak Swahili, they speak French, add on top English. So I am really impressed and inspired by the students, because there's that willingness to learn. They just want to learn because they want to participate in the community. They want to volunteer. They would love to participate in community events or even get work and contribute to the economy of this country.
That was a Multicultural Queensland Awards winner, Ben Mayo, speaking with the Wire's Tony Pankalush. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Amina Shakur in Melbourne. A big hello to our listeners in Alice Springs on ACCC 102.1 FM. And to our friends in Noosa on Noosa FM 101.3. And to the other side of the country, to Radio Gulari in Broome, Western Australia. The federal government has just over 3 months to implement a ban on social media access for all Australians under the age of 16. This week, a report into how this could work was released. While the government says it shows there is a clear path forward, experts aren't convinced. Community Radio Network political reporter Noah Sacombe has the story.
The Age Assurance Technology Trial, published yesterday, outlines 12 main findings after the months-long process. Findings 1, 2 and 7 suggest age assurance can be done in Australia, there aren't substantial technological limitations, and different systems performed broadly consistent. However, finding 4 concedes there is no one-size-fits-all solution. Finding 10 says systems generally align with cybersecurity best practice, but vigilance is required. And finding 11 warns that unnecessary data retention may occur in apparent anticipation of future regulatory needs.
Not only the scheme is flawed, but the scheme is flawed because the policy is flawed to start with.
John Payne is the chair of Electronic Frontiers Australia, one of the nation's longest-running non-profit online privacy advocacy groups, and was on the advisory board of the Age Assurance Tech Trial. Mr. Payne quit from this position in August over concerns the trial wasn't serious about protecting the privacy of users. Here's his reaction to the release of the final report.
The technology trial was built on the foundations of a policy that had numerous logical holes in it and didn't rely upon the full suite of evidence in relation to it. It failed to properly define the problem. It's only done that 50%, I would say. It's half-baked. Because the government's defined social media platforms as the problem and causing harms. What they haven't dealt with and what the legislation can't fix is the algorithmically driven modification of surveillance-based data extracted business model they have, keeping you on the device.
One of the quotes that we saw from the communications minister, the trial shows that there are many effective options and importantly that user privacy can be safeguarded. Do you think that that's actually a reasonable conclusion to reach?
If I had concerns in relation to the trial and some of the findings on privacy in particular in relation to it, One of the concerns was the use of rhetoric, which makes for very good political sound bites, saying that the trial found age assurance could be done privately, effectively, and efficiently. When I actually asked the board what private meant, the answers were not unsurprising. Privacy was somehow conflated solely down to the principles of confidentiality and security, when in fact data privacy is enormously more complex than that. We initially had concerns around some of the claims that were made in the preliminary report, and they seem to be remade in the final report. How organisations were assessed for their privacy capabilities seem to be looking at their privacy policy that they make available online, which is simply a document in legal verbiage that's been written by lawyers to manage legal risks. And lastly, the strongest concern that I had, and which really threw up a red light for us, was the trial found that some of the vendors were proposing as part of their product offering to keep personal data, including biometric data, for extended periods of time. And they did it on the basis that someday, somewhere in the future, a regulator might actually make a request for this data, or a coroner's court might make a request. Now, there's an obligation under data privacy law that's been in existence since 1988 to take reasonable steps to destroy personal data when you no longer need it. Unless you have a legal obligation to retain personal data for a period of time, whether you're a private sector or public sector, you should be getting rid of it as soon as possible, and particularly biometric data. And the trial seemed to have written this up as a potential risk, and absolutely right, no argument from us. But their solution to this risk was, you know, greater education and guidance from the regulatory bodies must come. Well, I'm sorry, there's been an entire body of work from regulatory bodies from the IIC over the past 20 years that tells people what they need to do. So it's pretty shocking that in 2025, organisations don't understand legal obligations for privacy that, you know, were passed at the turn of the millennia. And it points precisely to the fact why our Privacy Act is not fit for purpose, and it needs to be replaced with something that is compatible with today's technology-driven environment.
Today, the Communications Minister, Annika Wells, faced the media and dismissed suggestions there are concerns raised by the report.
Clearly, what the age assurance trial has shown us is that there are private, efficient and effective ways for all platforms to assure themselves of people's ages on their platforms in this country. But I would also say there is a misinformation campaign out there about erosions of privacy. The Albanese government has always stood for privacy and for improvements to privacy laws. And that is why we have enshrined in the social media minimum age laws a requirement that platforms offer an alternative to age verification than having to upload your identification online.
Minister Wells did admit it is a huge trust exercise in tech platforms, and that the government will not do anything to jeopardise the privacy of Australian users. When asked to confirm that there is no risk of platforms retaining information, as per finding 11 of the Age Assurance report, here's what she said.
And that is a conspiracy theory out there, and I'm happy to knock it off today.
Communications Minister Annika Wells ending the report from Noah Saccombe. Protesters are demonstrating outside Indonesian consulates across Australia today after crackdowns on pro-democracy voices in West Papua. Advocates warn on systematic regression of free speech in West Papua. The accusation comes amidst deadly nationwide protests against the current Indonesian government. West Papua human rights activist Zelda Grimshaw says today's protest aims to bring spotlight on political persecution.
West Papua has been occupied by Indonesia for over 60 years now. Historically, West Papuans have always asserted independence and have wanted to be their own country, but Indonesia has militarily occupied West Papua since 1963, and the movement for independence has never stopped. It continues, and military repression of that movement has always been severe. But last week, on Wednesday of last week, the 27th of August, four men who were prisoners of the Indonesian occupation were transferred from the city of Sorong in West Papua out of West Papua to another prison. The four men who were being transferred had petitioned for peace talks. So that was their crime. They had gone to the head of police and said, we want to initiate some peace talks towards resolving the West Papua issue. For that, they were charged with treason. So talking about peace in West Papua is seen as treason. So these four men were charged with treason, and then they were transferred away from the island. So this is a technique that the Indonesian regime has used across time with a number of political prisoners who were typically charged with treason. They move them away from West Papua to isolate and demoralise the prisoners. People in the West Papuan town of Sorong rebelled against the transfer of these prisoners and demanded that the prisoners remain in West Papua. That demonstration became very heated, and some demonstrators attacked government buildings, broke windows at the governor's residence, for instance. The Indonesian police then pointed the finger at a young independence leader called Sayang Mandabayan. Now, Sayang Mandabayan's a mother of five. She's been a vocal human rights advocate and pro-independence advocate for many years. She has been jailed once before for treason, but was let out because the police lost the evidence. Well, that's what they said. But they targeted her over this damage to government buildings, which Sayang, of course, had nothing to do with. They then went out and arrested 33 West Papuan activists. So all in one go, they went out and raided people's homes and arrested 33 activists who are pro-independence. So while they are arresting and jailing urban activists like Sayang Mandabayan, up in the mountains, the Indonesian military are torching villages. They're torching villages, clearing them out of people. There are tens of thousands of refugees in the mountains of West Papua because of Indonesian military activity. So across Indonesia and in West Papua, we are saying military back to the barracks. Resolution can happen through dialogue. It's not going to happen through the barrel of a gun. So we've called this snap rally to say stop the repression, end the persecution of Sayang Mandabayan. She is a peaceful pro-democracy advocate, and we are calling for international attention to be brought to this case because people like Sayang Mandabayan should not be in fear of their lives.
You talked about the international community. So can you walk me through what role they're currently playing, including Australia, in this crisis?
So Australia has close ties with Indonesia. Even though the current president of Indonesia has been on trial for war crimes and crimes against humanity in the past, Prabowo Subianto was dishonourably discharged from the army in 1998 for his involvement with the kidnap, torture and disappearance of pro-democracy activists in Jakarta. Prabowo has also been involved in massacres in East Timor and in West Papua. So very chilling for anyone who is a democracy advocate or a human rights advocate. Australia has maintained normal relations with Prabowo Subianto. They have not raised any objections at all about his personal human rights record or about the repression of activists in West Papua. And indeed, we're seeing over this past week huge demonstrations, huge furious expressions of popular discontent with the Prabowo regime across Indonesia. So what's happened in West Papua is one example, but in fact, people all over Indonesia are furious with the Prabowo regime, they're furious with austerity, they're furious with corruption, and they're furious with Prabowo increasing militarism in Indonesia. That's what the riots all over Indonesia are demanding. Put the military back in the barracks, stop sending soldiers out onto our streets. If you're in Darwin or Canberra or Melbourne, you can come along to the Indonesian consulate today at 12:30 for a snap protest against Indonesian repression of democracy activists in general and of Sayang Mandabayan in particular.
That was West Papua human rights activist Zelda Grimshaw speaking with The Wire's Calvin Lee. And unfortunately, that's the end of today's show. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Brisbane. With the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and Community Radio Network. Check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, X and LinkedIn. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, where the program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. I'm Mermina Shikuru, coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.